Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dollars for Detroit, shoes fly in Baghdad, deflation news, Caroline Kennedy, and a blast from the past this week. The White House makes its move on Detroit. President Bush said he didn't want to dump it on Obama.
I believe that good policy is not to dump him a major catastrophe in his first day of office.
Caroline Kennedy, daughter of JFK, put her hand up for a Senate seat.
I come at this as a mother, as a lawyer, as an author, as an education advocate, and, you know, from a family that really has spent generations in public service.
And deep throat of Watergate fame, FBI man Mark Felt is dead at 95. Here's Hal Holbrook in the role in All the President's Men.
Cover-up had little to do with Watergate. It was mainly to protect the covert operations. It leads everywhere.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Bailout, Madoff, cabinet picks, Rick Warren. Is the Fed getting a handle on this economy? Joining us today from Washington is Ruth Marcus, editorial writer and columnist for The Washington Post. Ruth, thanks for being there.
Hi.
And with us from Washington is David Leonhardt. He writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times and writes for the Economics with an X blog at nytimes.com. David, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ruth.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ruth, and David.
Here we are, straight off the president, talking about what the White House is going to do, talking this morning at the White House, saying the auto industry bailout that he's proposing here will prevent further blows to a weak U.S. economy. Let's listen.
There's too great a risk that bankruptcy now would lead to a disorderly liquidation of American auto companies. My economic advisors believe that such a collapse would deal an unacceptably painful blow to hardworking Americans far beyond the auto industry. It would worsen a weak job market and exacerbate the financial crisis. It could send our suffering economy into a deeper and longer recession.
President Bush, Friday morning, and so $17 billion in loans for the auto industry. David Leonhardt, you are economics guy. What do you make of the White House take and response to Detroit here?
Well, like a lot of economists, the White House decided that the economy is just too weak now to allow the natural result to happen here. And the natural result is essentially for Ford and GM, less so Ford, but certainly GM and Chrysler, to go into bankruptcy because they're failing companies. But given that we're in the midst of the worst recession in a generation and maybe longer, that could have really bad spillover consequences. And so the idea is to prop them up for the short term and in exchange force them to come up with a plan that makes them viable. And viable is the nice word. The more accurate, less nice word is smaller. They have to be smaller companies to reflect the fact that many people in this country don't want to buy their vehicles.
Plan to make them viable. Does that mean that the arm twisting has yet to happen, David? That's what I couldn't quite make out here. I mean, in a bankruptcy, the bankruptcy court judge gets a lot of power. He can leverage a lot of concessions. President Bush talked about concessions, but does it appear they've already been promised from management, labor, suppliers?
Well, as I understand this plan, there's a deadline of March 30th, and the companies have to prove that they're viable by then in order to keep the loans. In order to not have to pay back the loans immediately. And so that is a pretty big stick hanging over the heads of the companies and the unions and the investors and the debt holders and all the people involved here. And so although the concessions haven't exactly been signed off on yet, the idea is to force them to do so in very short order.
This is big. Let's listen to a little bit more of the president this morning throwing a line to those automakers in trouble.
By giving the auto companies a chance to restructure, we will shield the American people from a harsh economic blow at a vulnerable time. And we will give American workers an opportunity to show the world once again they can meet challenges with ingenuity and determination and bounce back from tough times and emerge stronger than before.
Emerge stronger than before, the president forecast for Detroit, or at least the chance to do that. Ruth Marcus, this is some bitter medicine for a Republican administration here. From Wall Street all the way to Detroit now, bailout billions.
I'm glad you said bitter medicine, because I was going to make another health analogy. Mm-hmm. I think David's exactly right. What we have right now is a patient who is just in terrible shape. And the important thing to do right now is simply to get the patient stabilized and then just determine what needs to be done, whether the patient can ultimately be saved, what being saved would look like, and what that would require in terms of more extensive measures in the future. But I think that the White House has done the sensible and rational thing here. The thing that I think Congress ought to have done but didn't manage to get itself to do, which is to overcome its understandable and instinctive distaste for government intervention, government bailouts, and take the needs of the larger economy into account.
Jack, President Bush said he didn't want to leave a mess, a catastrophe in the lap of the incoming President Barack Obama. But this $17 billion, these loans, I mean, this hardly solves Detroit's problems. It's we've still got a huge mess here.
We do, but there are two clocks here. There's the long clock of Detroit's decline, and then there's the shorter one of this financial crisis. I read in the news this week that Honda's sales are down 35%. Mm-hmm. Terrible year for Toyota. And it's very hard analytically for me to separate, what is this long-term decline in Detroit from this financial crisis now and the credit crunch in particular. And my hope is that an easing of credit, and perhaps the Federal Reserve can help there, could bring a little recovery there, and we'll, to the point where we can see what's what. We can see, just how much is the tertiary failure of these companies and how much is this exacerbation by the financial crisis.
We've got so much news this week, it's hard to know how to get through it. Let's keep clicking. David Leonhardt, on the economic front, we've got the Fed taking interest rates down near zero this week, word of deflation. Put the Detroit situation in the bigger context for us. What is going on with the economic crisis we're in the midst of, David?
Well, shoppers are sort of gone on strike. It's really amazing. Spending has fallen so rapidly that in order to get people to buy their products, companies are having to cut their prices. We've seen prices fall over the last 3 months by about 3% across the economy. The last time we saw that was 1933, mm-hmm. amazingly enough. And so this is a funny thing, because in the short term, it's actually good. The cost of living is falling for all of us, and we could use that right now because mm-hmm. unemployment is rising, because our retirement accounts are worth less than they used to be. And so the idea that the economy is on sale in the short term is a really good thing. The worrisome thing is that this could become a spiral, a deflationary spiral, in which we all stop shopping because we think to ourselves, wait a second, that car I want to buy or that computer I want to buy is going to be a lot cheaper 6 months from now than it is today, so I won't go buy it now. And that weakens the economy further. And that's really what the Federal Reserve and a lot of other policymakers are worried about. And that's why you saw them take this aggressive move this week to bring interest rates essentially down to zero, short-term interest rates. And so they're going to flood the economy with cash in an attempt to prop up prices or keep them from falling too much.
When you get down near zero, there's not a whole lot more you can do on that front. Barack Obama talked about that a bit earlier this week. This is a Tuesday press conference where he was marching out cabinet members. Here he was talking about Bernanke's decision to take the interest rate way down.
We are running out of the traditional ammunition that's used in a recession, which is to lower interest rates. They're getting to be about as low as they can go. And although the Fed is still going to have more tools available to it, it is critical that the other branches of government step up.
David Leonhardt, what does that mean? You can't get much lower on interest rates than zero. What does it mean, others stepping up? And how do we keep foreign investors putting money into this country when our interest rate is near zero?
Well, the answer to that last question is that they don't really have any other attractive places to go right now. This is a global financial crisis, and it's affecting all sorts of companies, all sorts of countries. And so in a funny way, for all of our problems, we still look, amazingly enough, relatively safe to a lot of global investors. So that's not a problem right now. It could become one, but it's not one right now. What Obama was referring to there was the idea that the Fed can't do too much more, so Congress and the president have to start spending money. And they are now talking about stimulus packages in the range of $800-900 billion, probably over 2 years, which is a pretty amazing number. I mean, it's roughly 3% of the economy each year. That's pretty incredible.
Ruth, there in Washington, do you feel any doubt that the Obama administration and Congress with Republicans will step up and pull the trigger on whatever it's going to be, $600 billion, $850 billion, $1 trillion in stimulus when they hit the ground after Inauguration Day?
The only doubt is the actually how many zeros or maybe what the first number is. Will it be $600 billion or $800 billion, or will we get to the trillion mark? Because I think that while President Bush appropriately said he did not want to leave a crisis for his successor, he is, without casting blame here, and because blame could go in various different ways, there is a crisis. There are kind of multiple crises. He's put a Band-Aid on one of them. But I think the political reality is that the president-elect wants and is crafting an enormous stimulus package. He is going to have both a Democratic House that will be behind this and a much beefed up majority in the Democratic Senate, so that those elusive 60 votes in these circumstances, I don't think will be too hard to come by. So the question is really the size and the mixture of a stimulus package or recovery package, as we're now told to call it, and not whether it will happen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Shoes fly in Baghdad. Deflation. Caroline Kennedy steps up. Deep Throat checks out. And more. Ruth Marcus joins us from The Washington Post. David Leonhardt from The New York Times. Jack Beatty's here as well. Early in the week in Baghdad on Sunday, Iraqi television journalist Muntadhar al-Zaidi hurled his shoes at President Bush. Let's listen. Translation of his comments. This is a gift from the Iraqis. This is the farewell kiss, you dog. And we've all seen what happened since then. On Monday in Baghdad, protesters marched in the streets demanding the release of the jailed journalist who had thrown his shoes. And he's still getting big play all over the Arab world. Jack, this wasn't what President Bush wanted to come out of Iraq talking about or the images that he wanted, but there they are. They're all over the planet.
They're all over the planet, and it's come out, of course, that this man's family had suffered in this occupation. You know, this comes out just as an Oxfam report has been released on life in Iraq, and some of the statistics: 4 million Iraqis cannot regularly buy enough food, 70% are without adequate water supplies. That was 50% in 2003, 28% of children malnourished compared to 19%, 92% of Iraqi children suffer learning problems, mostly due to the climate of fear. You know, we had an Iraqi intellectual on this program some time ago, and he gave, I thought, the most vivid metaphor for what's happened. He said, under Saddam, Iraq was like a cancer patient, and a butcher came along and cut out the cancer.
And it's gone. Let's take a call from Newton, Massachusetts. Sai, you're on the air.
Yes, I feel you spokesman right now makes a major mistake. It's called the abuse excuse. Now, I did not vote for Bush, and I do not defend Bush, but I think he represents our country. He is our elected president. This was a spit in the face of American people, in spit of the face of our nation. This is the deepest insult in Arab customs, which I studied for years. Mm-hmm. It's throwing off a shoe, calling him a dog. Maybe he should have called infidel dog, but he was restricted. Under Saddam Hussein, he would have been tortured, so would be dozens of members of his family, and killed eventually. But the most important part, the point I want to make, is this. If we do not respond more strongly, we're giving the excuses and we feel sorry for his family.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to have very serious consequences, possibly a few suitcase bombs after Iran gets weapons by terrorists in New York, Washington, and perhaps Boston.
Masai, what are you saying? That there should be a response like Saddam Hussein's response would have been? Should he be killed with all his family?
I don't say we should do that, but we should have much stronger protests against insulting our nation instead of trying to justify and explain how he suffered, just like Versailles Treaty was excused for Nazism. I think it's a major mistake not to respond very, very strongly. As an insult, the president represents our nation.
We've got the perspective. Ruth Marcus, we've got a big cultural meeting here and a fiery one that it may be more significant than many Americans really see, as Sai points out, in these flying shoes.
I think that the caller makes the really critical point about what would have happened to this gentleman under the Saddam Hussein regime. And I take exactly the opposite lesson that he takes, which is, let's just turn the other cheek. The president ducked. He didn't get hit. It was an insult. We have a robust tradition in this country of not shoe hurling, but we can tolerate insulting foreign leaders. It's not appropriate behavior, but the alternative to make a martyr of this man, to further incite whatever hatred there is, justified or unjustified, of the United States, I think would be a huge mistake. And I thought the president had the best reaction, which was to kind of laugh it off and talk about the size of the shoe.
If you want to know, it's size 10, he said, but our caller sighs, not laughing. Let's go to Wendy in Canaan, New York. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. I think that George Bush should be tried in The Hague. I disagree with the gentleman that felt that this was an insult to our nation. Our nation should be held accountable for what George Bush has done.
Saddam Hussein's gone. Saddam Hussein is not hanging this guy by his thumbs. What about that?
I think this guy should be applauded for speaking out. I'm glad that, he hasn't been killed for his actions. But, I mean, that's a good sign for democracy that he's at least not being tortured. But I think everybody should be throwing shoes. And if I could get anywhere near, I would.
Wendy, thanks for your call. In this vein, let's listen to just a little bit of an interview with Vice President Dick Cheney. This was Monday on ABC News. Jonathan Carl interviewed the VP, asked Dick Cheney about the tactics that had been used to get information from Al-Qaeda's number three man, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do, and I supported it.
Do you think any of those tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others went too far?
I don't.
And on KSM, one of those tactics, of course, widely reported was waterboarding, and that seems to be a tactic we no longer use. Even that, you think, was appropriate?
I do.
The vice president, very blunt, very bluff, waterboarding appropriate? Do you think so? I do. Ruth Marcus, where does this go?
I don't think that actually the vice president said anything different from what he's previously said. He's been very clear that he thinks this is an appropriate tactic in certain circumstances. And I'm not sure that it should actually go anywhere. We have a new administration coming in that, thankfully and appropriately, from my point of view, is going to turn the page on the use of these tactics, which most people, myself included, would consider to be torture. But I think that's a terrific change. The new attorney general has been outspoken about this. President-elect has been outspoken about it. I'm not sure that looking back and trying to hold people accountable in war crimes trials or other venues is actually particularly helpful. What's helpful is for the United States to make it clear that it won't tolerate this kind of activity or engage in this kind of activity in the future.
Jack, what do you expect? Looking back or not?
I would hope at the least, as the New York Times called for in a recent editorial, a commission to look into this. You know, this Cheney statement came just as a bipartisan report was released by the Senate Armed Services Committee, making what the Times called, quote, a strong case for bringing criminal charges against Rumsfeld and some of his apparatchiks and even down to Alberto Gonzalez. And now, of course, you could almost say that the vice president himself for these sorts of techniques. And in this report, they cite the former Navy general counsel says there are serving U.S. flag officers who maintain that the first and second identifiable causes of U.S. deaths in Iraq, as judged by their effectiveness in recruiting insurgent fighters into combat, are respectively the symbols of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. That really is saying something. I think Americans need to find out if half of our soldiers' deaths can be traced to these violations of law. I think we have to uncover this. You know, the Pew Research Center just came out with a report, a poll that 50-some-odd% of Americans now ask the one word they think of with President Bush: it's incompetent. Well, there's no argument on that. But a stronger words may need to be used as more of this sort of thing comes out.
Let's get a call from Ipswich, Massachusetts, and Ken. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well.
Good. First, I want to say to Ruth Marcus, I really admire you, and I've been reading your stories for a long time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yep. I just wanted to comment about Mark Felt. I was, I guess, my late teens. I was about 18 when Watergate broke, and I just believe he was a true American hero. No one could have said that he was a leftist or a liberal. He was a dyed-in-the-wool, traditional. I mean, he was an FBI agent, for goodness sake.
Number two in the FBI, then. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, number two, as a matter of fact. So I believe he just recognized a crime, saw what was happening about it, which was generally nothing officially, and he acted on it in the best way that he thought could get some real results. And I just think he's really in the tradition of our greatest American patriots and heroes.
Ken, we've got it. A salute there, Ruth.
It's so interesting that, and appropriate in some ways, that Mark Felt's passing occurs at the time that we're having this conversation about how much to look backwards versus just shifting course mm-hmm. in terms of torture and other things, and whether criminal prosecution is appropriate, because as a very young reporter, and now I'm dating myself along with the caller, I happened to cover the trial of Mark Felt for illegal break-ins that the FBI engaged in. And there was a lot of controversy, and he was later, if I'm not wrong, pardoned for his role there. And there was a lot of controversy over whether it's useful and necessary and appropriate to hold people criminally responsible for actions. And I would actually just argue with Jack a little bit. I don't think that the criminalization of policy is a very good idea. And I would ask further, what is it, and I mean this sincerely, what information is it that we don't have at this point about Abu Ghraib, about torture, about other activities that the Bush administration was engaged in, that it's necessary, that it would be useful to exhume?
Let's hold that question for a second. I mean, maybe it is the information that we do have. We've got a caller on this front in New Britain, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air. Hello, Mark. Are you there?
Hi. Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little historical perspective here. In 1945, at the end of World War II, we tried Japanese army officers for waterboarding our troops. And when found guilty, we hanged them by the neck until dead. Dick Cheney just admitted on national television to a hanging offense. How do we just ignore this and move on? We can't. Not in a society that respects the rule of law.
Mark, let us pick it up further. David Leonhardt, you're listening in on all this, from Deep Throat and Mark Felt in Watergate days to torture and allegations right now. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll generally defer to Ruth on questions involving shoes and war crimes. But
you can have cars, David.
Thank you. But I do think there is an important distinction here. I think Ruth's right that there are a number of areas in which we probably know almost as much as we're going to know. But setting aside for a second the criminalization question and not talking about that, I do think that even if you believe that we should not criminalize policy, there are a number of things that it will be important to know more about. And I think I think one of the things that we're going to want to do in the years to come is to try to make sure that some of the secrecy that has been imposed on the executive branch during the last 8 years is lifted. That doesn't mean we have to then go and prosecute some of the things that happened. But I do still think there are a number of things that have gone on over the last, not just 8 years, but certainly over the last 8 years, that we don't yet know about. And I hope that the change in power, in some ways as happened from Clinton to Bush, I hope that the change in power from Bush to Obama allows some of these things to come out separate from what we actually do about them.
Jack, what do you say to Ruth's challenge? What's to be gained from learning more? What don't we know, she asks.
Well, we don't know what we don't know. That's the answer there, it seems to me. And beyond that,
there's the knowns, right, Jack?
Right, as Don Rumsfeld memorably said. And beyond that, there's the principle of accountability. And there's the principle of showing before the world that we can look at our own conduct. Look, all over the world, this is what we have what we're unfortunately known for. A Pakistani journalist said, even the illiterates pronounce the word Guantanamo. We've got to get clear on this. This was perhaps the worst, mistake, malign mistake of the Bush administration. It's hurt us before the world, and before the world, if we could make a clean breast of it, have official hearings, more reports like this Senate report, hear things that we don't know. Perhaps criminal prosecutions can wait, although my strong prejudice would be to have them. But we need to face what we've done here, and I don't see that there's any harm in doing that.
Let's get a call from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think that the for me, the real issue is not so much finding stuff out, but giving what we know the official stamp of our society. I think our history would have been, things would have turned out very, very differently if Richard Nixon was impeached and there was a public stamp that what he did was wrong. There's tons of information about the Bush administration if you want to go and dig it, but there's no official stamp of society that they had done wrong. And to my way of thinking, this administration has done wrong on so many fronts. It's important for the American people to learn that governments lie, and they can lie in terrible ways, and to put the official stamp of society on it. We officially say, this is what happened. I don't know whether it needs to be a criminal trial. At the very least, something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that officially says, this is what happens. Society does not condone it.
Sam, thanks for calling. Ruth, are you persuaded? Move on or look back somehow. Sam in Lincoln says, Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
I've been trying to think this through a lot, and I don't think I'm at a final sort of decision point yet, because I, as a journalist, am generally in favor of information, and as somebody who cares about history, I think it's extraordinarily important to understand history for the obvious reasons. At the same time, I think that if you look at other nations that have had Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, South Africa dealing with the legacy of apartheid, Argentina dealing with the legacy of the disappeared, we're talking about a sort of much deeper, more systemic problem with the national culture and the national approach. We have had the functioning of democratic government here. We've had useful, important, necessary reports by Congress. We've had useful, important, necessary reports by inspector generals like Glenn Fine at the Justice Department. Mm. We have had the ultimate result of democracy, which is an election that rejected this approach. So I'm not sure what is to be gained and whether it rises to the level of those other societies where truth and reconciliation was important.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And in other news this week, the country's first face transplant was announced at the Cleveland Clinic.
The surgery took 22 hours. The preparation took over 20 years of work in the field of composite tissue transplantation.
America's most wanted crusading dad, John Walsh, got police confirmation of his son's killer 27 years after his six-year-old Adam's abduction.
The not knowing is almost as bad as the murder, but today's a good day. Today's a wonderful day. We can end this chapter of our lives.
And the late night crowd goofed on shoes in Baghdad. Here's Craig Ferguson.
Do you know, the shoe-throwing incident has made Sarah Palin want to be president even more. Free shoes, you betcha.
We're looking at a week in the news. Those shoes in Baghdad, deflation, Caroline Kennedy, deep throat checking out. Ruth Marcus is here from the Washington Post, David Leonhardt from the New York Times, and our own Jack Biddy. Just on the last bit, let's get one more call from Waynesboro, Georgia. Max, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just find it interesting that some of the other callers and Jack are so interested in putting folks, charging them with criminal charges and putting them in jail for protecting this country. And I just hope that in the future, as some of our agencies' hands are tied for trying to obtain time-sensitive information that could save people's lives, that President-elect Obama can have the same track record as President Bush has had over the last 8 years.
When it comes to attacks on the country 8 years from now. Max, thanks very much for that. We've got so many comings and goings and hands up this week. I want to start to get to them. Caroline Kennedy saying she wants to go to the U.S. Senate. Here she is yesterday. She ate fried chicken and collard greens with Al Sharpton in Harlem and described the type of Democrat she'd be as a senator.
I feel like I'm a Kennedy Democrat, a Clinton Democrat, Chuck Schumer, Barack Obama. I mean, these are all leaders whose values I share.
Ruth Marcus, what do you make of Caroline Kennedy's hand up? You said you've got mixed feelings in your column about the whole dynastic piece, but you came down for expressing some warmth toward this idea. And as I read you, your inbox just exploded.
It kind of exploded. I just got an email this morning describing my approach as, quote, sappy drivel. So you might take this
nice
sappy drivel with a crowd. That was one of my nicer comments, actually. And, you know, it's nice to create robust debate. I thought this week was very interesting in terms of Caroline Kennedy's debut as a possible U.S. senator. It was a little bit rocky. She made a trip to upstate New York, which is a very good thing to do, but she was sort of not answering questions. The New York Press Corps, famously not gentle with its subjects,
mm-hmm,
was yelling questions at her and saying, but you're not answering our questions. You're not answering our questions. I thought by the time she broke bread and ate ribs with Reverend Sharpton, she was sort of on a better track. But I do think that that was a pretty broad brush of what kind of Democrat she is. I think she ought to sort of step up and explain to the people of New York why she wants to be their senator, what she'd like to do for them as their senator, why she thinks it's appropriate for her to kind of leapfrog her way past the normal process into this job. And I think that would be very useful for people to hear. As I've said, my heart is kind of with her. I'm of Caroline Kennedy's age, and it just would be a sort of appropriate coda to a sort of tragic national moment to see her in the Senate following in the footsteps of her father, taking the seat held by her slain uncle, joining her remaining uncle who's terribly ill in the Senate to continue the work. And that's where the sappy drivel part comes from.
Let's hear from our listeners on that front. Mike in Beaufort, North Carolina. Mike, what do you think?
Oh, my God. I think that is such a wrong-headed opinion, I'm sorry to say.
You're in the sappy drivel camp, too?
I mean, it's what about the New Yorkers who need an effective legislature? I mean, at a time when Congress is at an all-time low, when lobbyists are at least paying for favors of senators, and when the governor, the idiot of Illinois, is offering to sell it, here we are, someone from out of state, from Washington, a pundit, is saying it would feel good for her to see someone from her era, whatever, coming in. I mean, I think it's just totally the wrong thing to do with a Senate seat at this time.
Let us stay on it. David Leonhardt, first to you. What do you think about Caroline Kennedy in her hand up?
Yeah, I'm a native New Yorker. I don't live in the state now, but I've lived in the state for more than half my life. And to me, what it reminds me of is the sad state of New York politics in general. The state legislature in New York is really one of the least effective and most conflicted legislatures in the entire country. The ethics rules are barely worthy of the name rules. Mm. And the excitement in some quarters and disgust in others that the Caroline Kennedy possibility has caused, I think, is in part a reflection of how few really exciting politicians there are in New York State right
now. Does that
now.
Mean it was sad when Bobby Kennedy came in, when Hillary Clinton came in? I mean, also, you know,
well, there's
in.
An aspect of that. I mean, I think part of the reason why we have outsiders come into New York is because New York is a place that people want to come to. Right, it's not just any old state. It's the state that has the most dynamic city in the country and probably the world. I'll say subjectively, and yet we really have an incredibly shallow bench in New York. There are not a lot of exciting young politicians. That doesn't mean that Caroline Kennedy should necessarily become senator. I'm just saying it's sad that we can't immediately tick off the names of three or four or five young people who we can say, look, this person's been in the legislature for 10 years, and or not young people, and they've done all these exciting things to improve schools, or this person has done these incredible things in New York City. Politics in New York is really sick, and the saddest thing about the whole Elliott Spitzer situation was he diagnosed the problem in many ways absolutely correctly. He wasn't very good at solving it even before his scandal. But what was so sad is that this was the first person in a long time who was elected to office basically saying, this culture is really, really sick, this political culture. So I wish that we could come up with four or five people and say, that person's exciting and they're far more qualified than Caroline Kennedy. It's hard to do in a state like New York.
Spitzer made the claim at the diagnosis and then flamed out himself. Jack, what do you say?
Well, you know, just to look at it in a tough-minded way, what's in it for a New York citizen? And potentially a lot. New York has a chronic problem. It is a massive outflow state. That is, as Senator Moynihan and others complained for years, New York gives far more in federal taxes than it gets back. It gets back 79 cents for every dollar of federal taxes. Southern states get back well over a dollar per dollar given to the federal government. Caroline Kennedy has had a longstanding and intimate involvement with the problems of the New York City schools. You can't talk about those problems without looking at special education. Quarter of the city's budget goes to special education. In 1980, $38,000 a year $38,000 a year was the price tag for this very important program. The federal government, two decades ago, said that they were going to take over full responsibility or almost full responsibility for special education. They never have. They've never fully funded it. Caroline Kennedy is a friend of Barack Obama. New York has always looked for a way that would benefit it, but that would also benefit the rest of the country. Nothing could do so more than having the federal government take over fully funding special education.
Sounds like maybe you're for it, but Ruth Marcus's inbox, maybe not.
Beware.
So much. Beware.
Beware.
Yeah, we hear that. Let's look at, on another side here, Blagojevich, still very much in the news this year. Illinois impeachment inquiry there. Heard from his lawyer, Ed Jensen, who just sort of went off on them, questioning their evidence, butting heads here with Illinois Democratic State Representative Jack Franks.
The issue in this case is the evidence that you have. The evidence you have is nil, zero,
nothing. We haven't tried
the
case. We are getting evidence now.
This isn't evidence, and that's my argument. If you let me finish, I'll finish, and then you can go and talk among yourselves and maybe even decide that I'm wrong.
Blagojevich talking today. We hear David Leonhardt. What do you think about this case?
Well, as a New Yorker, I'm very grateful for Illinois because it actually is a state that makes our politics look good.
Right.
Clearly, he cannot be governor anymore. He should resign.
So you say, but his attorney says, where's the evidence?
Well, I'm not sure there's a lot of evidence of criminality, but it does seem like he's not fit to govern at this point. And there's an interesting question about the level of criminality, but it's going to take a while for the legislature in Illinois to remove him, and so if he decides he doesn't want to go, he may not go anytime soon.
Let's get a call from Adam Trucker. Adam on I-81 in Virginia. Adam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I guess my point is
you know, we have to hold our elected officials accountable. There's nothing greater than protecting this country with truth and justice. In criminal acts, it's incredible.
But who are you pointing? Where are you pointing there, Adam? Blagojevich or somewhere else?
Oh, all of them. You got 40 years of, 40 years of the same thing. I mean, you know, and Bush is just shut it because he goes back through the past and makes new policy with old mistakes, and it's okay. You know, by not impeaching Nixon, it allowed the politicians to go ahead and just go ahead and quit, not be accountable, which really shows that we the people don't have any power. It's sad to say that the second man in the FBI had to leak information to do the right thing.
Adam, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. We've got a lot of cabinet picks to look at here. Let's start. Here's Barack Obama talking about his nominee for Education Secretary, Arne Duncan, ahead of Chicago Public Schools. At a press conference in Chicago, Obama spoke about the importance of improving America's, or Arne Duncan spoke about the importance of improving America's, the country's educational system.
Whether it's fighting poverty, strengthening our economy, or promoting opportunity, education is the common thread. It is the civil rights issue of our generation, and it is the one sure path to a more equal, fair, and just society.
Ruth Marcus in Washington, what do you think about the names that Obama's marching out this week? Salazar on Interior, you've got Arne Duncan here on Education right on down the line. How's this team look?
I actually think it's a very impressive team. I had assumed a few weeks ago that when conservatives were expressing a lot of relief about the national security and economic picks, that was going to be the high water mark of their happiness with the nascent Obama administration. And liberals, of course, were having some concerns about where things were trending. I think it's been surprising in the last few weeks how much that initial reaction in terms of this is a centrist, for the most part, cabinet that the president-elect is assembling, how much that has held true. And I think Arne Duncan is a very good choice for Education Secretary. He's a choice that actually manages to mollify or be acceptable to both the reform elements and to the unions. And he's done a very good job of bringing both of those forces together in Chicago, though it certainly does not have a perfect school system by any means. And I think he could be a very important force for the future.
David Leonhard, how about Ray LaHood, Secretary of Transportation? Here's another Republican after Robert Gates at Defense. What's the meaning of this? Infrastructure is in Barack Obama's sights, all kinds of green issues around transportation and economic issues. How do you interpret Ray LaHood, Congressman from Illinois, downstate?
One of the interesting things is that the current Secretary of Transportation, Mary Peters, also obviously a Republican, has been very interested in trying to do more cost-effectiveness studies in terms of how we spend our money on infrastructure. And we don't do nearly enough of that right now. And so it's, if you think about it, it could be a really good combination to have Obama, a Democrat, coming in saying we're going to spend a lot of money. And if you can have LaHood, if you imagine that as a Republican he may continue some of the kinds of things that Mary Peters has done, you can hope that maybe he will try to push a little bit to make sure that money isn't just spent on things that employ people, but is spent on things that employ people and make our infrastructure better. Because simply building new roads by themselves isn't guaranteed to make the infrastructure better. You also have to make sure you're not building new roads that are basically pork. You have to make sure that you're not building new roads that aren't immediately going to fill up, as new roads sometimes are. And so, you know, at the beginning of an administration, you can always look on the bright side of things. But I think that's another appointment where there is reason to have some hope that it could turn out well.
So many callers we're not going to get here. Ruth in Northwood, New Hampshire says, what does it mean with Caroline Kennedy? Do you have to be royalty to be a senator in this country? Randy in Statesboro, Georgia says, proud of Bush. And if you've got Obama in there, why do you need Caroline? What about this Rick Warren for giving the invocation at the inauguration? Ruth Marcus, evangelical. Everybody saw him sit down with McCain and Obama for that those interviews. Is this the kind of new politics that Barack Obama needs to bring? Or, are you in the camp of some gays and others who say this is all wrong for Obama?
I'm a little, as a supporter of gay rights and gay marriage and a supporter of abortion rights, I have to say I'm a little bit uncomfortable personally with the Rick Warren choice. I do think that from the president-elect's point of view, it sends a signal to – he's sold something like 45 million books. It sends a signal of inclusiveness and centrism. On the other hand, the fact that Rick Warren was so involved in opposing Proposition 8 in California, which took away from people who had been given a right to have marriages like everybody else, and he was involved in the effort to take away that right, I can completely understand. And I share the unhappiness of the gay community and certainly the pro-choice community in thinking, wow, maybe this centrism is going a little bit too far in this case.
But Jack, if Barack Obama's got new politics, if he's going to reach out, isn't this walking the walk?
This may be walking on the wild side or too far away. I mean, it's an affront to the estimated 7 million gay and lesbians who voted for Obama and who did so with the expectation that, as he put it, that he was a passionate advocate for their rights. This, I'm afraid, is an insult to them.
An affront there, but maybe a welcome, Matt, to some other Americans. So much news this week. We're grateful to all of you for helping us dive into it. David Leonhardt with The New York Times. David, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks, Tom.
Ruth Marcus with The Washington Post. Great to have you, Ruth. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.